to Happy Thanksgiving. And as she headed down the beach, Lisa continued her story. So they sent me the death certificate, and the cause isn't listed as a drug overdose, but as asphyxiation. I don't get it, I said. She sniffed her hands for dog and then stuffed them into her coat pockets. After taking the Klonopin, Tiffany put a plastic bag over her head. Lisa paused a moment to let that sink in. I wrote to the state trooper who found her body and sent him a picture of her in her 20s, the pretty one we ran with her obituary. I just wanted him to know she was more than what he walked in on. I've always liked to think that before killing myself, I take the time to really mess with people. By this, I mean that I'd leave them things and write letters, nice ones, apologizing for my actions and reassuring them that there was nothing they could have said or done to change my mind. In the fantasy, I'd leave money to those who'd have never expected it. Who's he? They'd wonder after opening the envelope. It might be a Polish lifeguard at the pool I used to go to in London, or a cashier I was quietly fond of. Only lately do I realize how ridiculous this is. When you're in the state that my sister was in, and that most people are in when they take their own lives, you're not thinking of anything beyond your own pain. Thus, the plastic bag, the maximizer, as it were, the thing a person reaches for after their first attempt at an overdose fails, and they wake up sick a day later thinking, I can't even kill myself right. It's hard to find a bag without writing on it, the name of a store, most often. Lowe's, it might read. Safeway. True Value. Does a person go through a number of them before making a selection? Or, as I suspect, will any bag do, regardless of the ironic statement it might make? This is what was going through my mind when Lisa stopped walking and turned to me, asking, will you do me a favor? Anything, I said, just so grateful to have her alive and beside me. She held out her foot. Will you tie my shoe? Well, sure, I said, but can you tell me why? She sighed. My pants are tight and I don't feel like bending over. I knelt down into the damp sand and did as she'd asked. It was almost dark, and as I stood back up, I looked at the long line of houses stretching to the pier. One of them belonged to us, but I couldn't have begun to guess which one it was. Judging by distance was no help either, as I had no idea how long we'd been walking. Lisa hadn't spent any more time at the C-section than I had, so she wasn't much help. Does our place have one deck or two? She asked. Two? I said. Unless it has only one? The houses before us were far from identical. They were painted every color you could think of, yet in the weak light, reduced to basic shapes, their resemblance was striking. All were wooden with prominent picture windows, all had staircases leading to the beach, and all had the air of a second home, one devoted to leisure rather than struggle. They likely didn't contain many file cabinets, but if you were after puzzles or golf clubs or board games, you'd come to the right place. The people in the houses looked similar as well. We could see them in their kitchens and family rooms, watching TV or standing before open refrigerators. They were white, for the most part, and conservative, the sort of people we'd grown up with at the country club, the kind who'd have sat in the front of the plane and laughed when the man across the aisle compared his broken overhead bin to Obamacare. That said, we could have knocked on any of these doors, explained our situation, and received help.
These folks have a house, but don't know which one it is, I could imagine a homeowner shouting over his shoulder into the next room. Remember when that happened to us?
It's silly, but after a while I started to panic, thinking, I guess, that we could die out there, in the cold, looking for one of my houses. I was just condemning Lisa for not bringing her phone when I spotted the broken fishing rod tied to our railing. I'd noticed it earlier that day and had made a mental note to remove it. Paul put it there so he'd be able to tell which house was ours, Gretchen had told me. I'd said, well, we'll see about that. Now, here I was, seeing about it. Hugh was in the kitchen on our side of the house making soup when we walked in.
"We got lost," Lisa told him. "Were you worried about us?"
He dried his hands on his apron and tried to pretend he'd known we were out.
"Was I ever?"
The air smelled pleasantly of chicken stock and onions. On the radio, it was announced that the president would be pardoning a turkey and that its name was Popcorn.
"That's nice," Lisa said.
While she went to her room to change, I walked through the connecting door and into the second kitchen. There I found Gretchen standing at the counter before a bowl of sliced apples.
"Did Lisa by any chance tell you about Tiffany?" I asked.
"The plastic bag, you mean?" Gretchen nodded. "She told me on the phone last week. I try not to think of it, but it's pretty much all I can think about. Our own sister, ending up that way." I walked to the window and looked at the sky, which had now gone from bruise-colored to black.
"Someone told me," I said, "that in Japan, if you commit suicide by throwing yourself in front of a train, your family gets fined the equivalent of $80,000 for all the inconvenience you caused."
From behind me, I could hear Gretchen slicing more apples.
"Of course," I continued, "if your family was the whole reason you were killing yourself, I suppose it would just be an added incentive."
Out on the beach, I could see the beam of a flashlight skittering across the sand. Someone was walking past the house, maybe to their own place, or perhaps to one they were renting for the long holiday weekend. If it was smaller than the C-section or less well-positioned, they maybe looked up into our gaily lit windows and resented us, wondering, as we often did ourselves these days, what we had done to deserve all this. The perfect fit. I'm not sure how it is in small families, but in large ones, relationships tend to shift over time. You might be best friends with one brother or sister, then 2 years later, it might be someone else. Then it's likely to change again and again after that. It doesn't mean that you've fallen out with the person you used to be closest to, but that you've merged into someone else's lane, or had him or her merge into yours. Trios form, then morph into quartets before splitting into teams of two. The beauty of it is that it's always changing. Twice in 2014, I went to Tokyo with my sister Amy. I'd been 7 times already, so was able to lead her to all the best places, by which I mean stores. When we returned in January 2016, it made sense to bring our sister Gretchen with us. Hugh was there as well. And while he's a definite presence, he didn't figure into the family dynamic. Mates to my sisters and me are seen mainly as shadows of the people they're involved with. They move, they're visible in direct sunlight. But because they don't have access to our emotional buttons, because they can't make us 12 again, or 5, and screaming, they really don't count as players. Normally in Tokyo, we rent an apartment and stay for a week. This time, though, we got a whole house. The neighborhood it was in, Ebisu, is home to one of our favorite shops, Capital. The clothes they sell are new, but appear to have been previously worn, perhaps by someone who was shot or stabbed, and then thrown off a boat. Everything looks as if it had been pulled from the evidence rack at a murder trial. I don't know how they do it. Most distressed clothing seems obviously fake, but not theirs for some reason. Do they put it in a dryer with broken glass and rusty steak knives? Do they drag it behind a tank over a still smoldering battlefield? How do they get the cuts and stains so right? If I had to use one word to describe Capital's clothing, I'd be torn between wrong and tragic. A shirt might look normal enough until you try it on and discover that the armholes have been moved and are no longer level with your shoulders, like a capital T, but further down your torso, like a lowercase one. Jackets with patches on them might senselessly bunch at your left hip, or maybe they poof out at the small of your back where, for no good reason, there's a pocket. I've yet to see a pair of capital trousers with a single leg hole, but that doesn't mean the designers haven't already done it. Their motto seems to be, why not? Most people would answer, I'll tell you, why not? But I like capital's philosophy. I like their clothing as well, though I can't say that it always likes me in return. I'm not narrow enough in the chest for most of their jackets, but what was to stop me on this most recent trip from buying a flannel shirt made of 5 differently patterned flannel shirts, ripped apart, and then stitched together into a kind of doleful Franken-top? I got hats as well, 3 of them, which I like to wear stacked up, all at the same time, partly just to get it over with, but mainly because I think they look good as a tower. I draw the line at clothing with writing on it, but numbers don't bother me, so I also bought a tattered long-sleeve T-shirt with 99 cut from white fabric and stitched onto the front before being half burned off. It's as though a football team's plane had gone down, and this was all that was left. Finally, I bought what might be called a tunic, made of denim and patched at the neck with defeated scraps of corduroy. When buttoned, the front flares out, making me look like I have a pot belly. These are clothes that absolutely refuse to flatter you. They go out of their way to insult you, really, and still, my sisters and I can't get enough. There are 3 capital stores in Ebisu, and their interior design is as off-putting as their merchandise. Most clothing hangs from the ceiling, though there are a few beaten-up racks and horizontal surfaces that items are strewn across. At one of the shops, the window display consisted of 3 carved penises, arranged from small to large. The most modest was on par with a Coleman thermos, while the king-size one was as long and thick as a wrestler's forearm. Amy's eyes popped out of her head. Before I could stop her, she hoisted the middle one out of the window, crying, "Oh my goodness, it's teak! I thought from out on the sidewalk that it was mahogany." As if she were a wood expert and saw nothing beyond the grain. The salesman blinked as Amy turned the dildo upside down. Then she positioned her right hand at the base of the testicles and pretended she was a waitress. Would anyone care for some freshly ground pepper? There are 3 other branches of Capital in Tokyo, and we visited them all and stayed in each one until our fingerprints were on everything. "My God," Gretchen said, trying on a hat that seemed to have been modeled after a used toilet brush and adding it to her pile. "This place is amazing. I had no idea." The main reason we asked Gretchen to join us is that she understands shopping. That is to say, she understands there is nothing but shopping. Unlike our brother Paul or our sister Lisa, whose disinterest in buying things is downright masculine, she and her husband Bob don't exchange Christmas gifts, but will rather go in on something, a new set of shelves for the laundry room, for instance, or a dehumidifier. They usually buy whatever it is in midsummer, so by December it's been forgotten. It's the same with their anniversary and birthdays. Nothing. "But you can change that," I often tell her. "Right," she says, the way I do when someone suggests I learn how to drive. And it's not just big ticket items. She and I were at O'Hare Airport one afternoon and passed a place that sold nuts. "Why don't you get some for Bob?" I asked. "It would be a nice little something to bring him as a gift." She looked at the stand, a cart really, and frowned. "I would, but his dentist told him he has brittle teeth." "He doesn't have to crack them open in his mouth," I said. "Everything here is pre-shelled." "That's okay." I would never leave town and not bring Hugh back a gift, nor would he do that to me, though in truth I had to train him. He's normally not that much of a shopper, but Tokyo seems to knock something loose in him. Perhaps it's because it's so far away. The difference is that he's ashamed of it. I think it's something he gets from his mother, who considers shopping to be wasteful, or, worse still in her book, unserious. "Why go to a store when you could go to a museum?" she might ask. Because the museum doesn't sell shit? My sisters and I refuse to feel bad about shopping, and why should we? Obviously, we have some hole we're trying to fill, but doesn't everyone? And isn't filling it with berets the size of toilet seat covers, if not more practical, then at least healthier than filling it with frosting or heroin or unsafe sex with strangers? "Besides," Amy said at the dinner table on the first night of our vacation, "it's not like everything we buy is for ourselves. I'll be getting birthday presents for friends and all sorts of things for my godson." "You don't have to convince me," I told her, "as we're cut from the same cloth." Shopping has nothing to do with money. If you have it, you go to stores and galleries, and if not, you haunt flea markets or Goodwills. Never, though, do you not do it, choosing instead to visit a park or a temple or some cultural institution where they don't sell things. Our sister-in-law Kathy swears by eBay, but I like the social aspect of shopping, getting out, touching things, and talking to people. I work at home, so most days the only contact I have, except for Hugh, is with salespeople and cashiers. My problem is that if someone really engages me or goes the slightest bit out of his way, I feel I have to buy whatever it is he's selling, especially if it involves a ladder or a set of keys. That explains the small painting of a forsaken shack I bought on the fourth day of our vacation at a place I like called On Sundays. It's on an odd-shaped scrap of plywood, and though it's by a contemporary artist I've always gotten a kick out of, an American named Barry McGee, and was probably a very fair price, I bought it mainly because the store manager unlocked the case that it was in. "I would have got it if you hadn't, Amy," my enabler said, as I left with the painting in a recently purchased, very pricey tote bag that had cowboys on it. Then it was on to another of our favorite places, the Tokyo outpost of the Dover Street Market. The original store in London sells both clothing and the kind of objects you might find in a natural history museum. I got the inner ear of a whale there a few years back, and a four-horned antelope skull that was found in India in 1890. The Ginza branch sticks to clothing and accessories. I'd gone with Amy on our first trip together in 2014 and left with a pair of wide-legged, Paul Harden trousers that come up to my nipples. The button-down fly is a foot long, and when I root around in my pockets for change, my forearms disappear all the way to the elbows. You can't belt something that reaches that high up on your torso, thus the suspenders, which came with the trousers and are beautiful, but still, suspenders. Clown pants is what they are, artfully hand-stitched, lined all the way to the ankle, but clown pants all the same. They cost as much as a MacBook Air, and I'd have walked away from them were it not for Amy saying, "Are you kidding? You have to get those." This time, I bought a pair of blue and white polka dot culottes. Hugh hates this sort of thing and accuses me of transitioning. "They're just shorts," I tell him. "Bell-bottom shorts, but shorts all the same. How is that womanly?" A year and a half earlier, at the same Dover Street Market, I bought a pair of heavy black culottes, dress culottes, you could call them, made by Comme des Garçons and also beautifully lined. They made a pleasant whooshing sound as I ran up the stairs of my house, searching in vain for whatever shoes a grown man might wear with them. Hugh disapproved, but again, I thought I looked great, much better than I do in regular trousers. "My calves are my one good feature," I reminded him as he gritted his teeth. "Why can't I highlight them every now and then?" The dress culottes weren't as expensive as the pants that come up to my nipples, but still they were extravagant. I buy a lot of what I think of as at-home clothes. things I'd wear at my desk or when lying around at night after a bath, but never outdoors. These troubling Jiminy Cricket-style trousers, for instance, that I bought at another of my favorite Japanese stores, 45 RPM. They have horizontal stripes and make my ass look like a half a dozen coins collected in a sack made from an old prison uniform. I'd have felt like a fool paying all that money and limiting my nipple-high pants and black dress culottes to home, so I started wearing them on stage, which still left me feeling like a fool, but a different kind of one. "I hate to tell you," a woman said after a show one night, "but those culottes look terrible on you." I was shattered. "Really? They're way too long," she told me. And so I had them shortened, then shortened again, at which point they no longer made the pleasant mushing sound and were ruined. "Are these too long for me?" I asked the saleswoman on our most recent trip. "Not at all," I'm pretty sure she told me. A few days later, at the big Comme des Garçons shop in Omotesando, I bought yet another pair of culottes, a fancier pair that are cerulean blue. "What are you doing?" Hugh moaned as I stepped out of the dressing room. "That's three pairs of culottes you'll own now." All I could say in my defense was, "Maybe I have a busy life." I then tried on a button-down shirt that was made to be worn backward. The front was plain and almost suggested a straitjacket. You'd have to have someone close you into it, and, of course, not your tie if you were going for a more formal look. I'd have bought it were it not too tight at the neck. "Maybe it will fit you after you have your Adam's apple shaved off," Hugh said. Amy loaded up at Comme des Garçons as well, buying, among other things, a skirt that looks to have been made from the insides of suit pockets. "What just happened?" she asked as we left the store considerably more broke and went up a few doors to Yoji Yamamoto, where I bought what Hugh calls a dress, but what is most certainly a smock, a denim one that has side pockets. The front closes with snaps, and for whatever reason, the back does as well. Most days we returned to our rental house, groaning beneath the weight of our purchases, things I'd often wind up regretting the moment I pulled them out of their bags. A pair of drawstring jeans, two sizes too large, for instance. Drawstring jeans. Or a wool shirt that was relatively sober and would have been great were I able to wear wool. As it is, it causes me to itch and sweat something awful. "Then why did you get it?" Hugh asked. "Because everybody else got something," I told him, adding that it was on sale and I could always send it to my father, who might not wear it but would undoubtedly appreciate the gesture. Shopping with my sisters in Japan was like being in a pie-eating contest, only with stuff. We often felt sick, dazed, bloated, vulgar, yet never quite ashamed. "I think I need to lie down," I said one evening, "maybe with that brand new $80 washcloth on my forehead." Nothing was a total waste, I reasoned, as paying for it gave me a chance to practice my Japanese. "I am buying something now," I'd say as I approached the register. "I have money. I have coins, too." As if he or she had been handed a script, the cashier would ask where I was from and what I was doing in Tokyo. "I am American," I would say, "but now I live in England. I am on vacation with my sisters." "Oh, your sisters." Then I started saying, "I am a doctor." "What kind?" asked a woman who sold me a bandana with pictures of fruit and people having sex on it. "A children's doctor," I said. I wouldn't set out to misrepresent myself, but I didn't know the words for author or trash collector. Doctor, though, was in one of the 90 teach-yourself Japanese lessons I'd reviewed before leaving England. I loved the respect being a pediatrician brought me in Japan. Even when I wore a smock and had a tower of three hats on my head, you could see it in people's faces. I grew before their very eyes. "Did you just tell that lady you're a doctor?" Amy would ask. "A little," I'd say. A week after leaving Tokyo, I was on a flight from Hobart, Tasmania, to Melbourne. And when a passenger got sick and the flight attendant asked if there was a physician on board, my hand was halfway to the call button before I remembered that I am not, in fact, a doctor. That I just play one in Japan. Though it cut into our shopping time, one thing we all looked forward to in Tokyo was lunch, which was always eaten out, usually at some place we just chanced upon. One afternoon toward the end of our vacation, settling into my seat at a tempura restaurant in Shibuya, I looked across the table at Amy, who was wearing a varsity sweater from Capital that appeared to have bloodstains and bits of brain on it, and at Gretchen with her toilet brush hat. I was debuting a shirt that fell 3 inches below my knees. It was black and made me look like a hand puppet. We don't have the same eyes or noses, my sisters and I. Our hairlines are different and the shapes of our faces, but on this particular afternoon, the family resemblance was striking. Anyone could tell that we were related, even someone from another planet who believed that humans were as indistinguishable from one another as acorns. At this particular moment of our lives, no one belonged together more than us. Who would have thought when we were children that the three of us would wind up here, in Japan of all places, dressed so expensively like mental patients and getting along so well together? It's a thought we all had several times a day. Look at how our lives turned out. What a surprise. When the menus came, Gretchen examined hers upside down. She had never used chopsticks before coming to Tokyo, and for the first few days she employed them separately, one in each hand, like daggers. Amy was a little better, but when it came to things like rice, she tended to give up and just stare at her bowl helplessly. Always, when the food was delivered, we'd take a moment to admire it, so beautifully presented, all this whatever it was, the little box with the round thing in it, the shredded bit, the flat part. Once we ate in what I'm pretty sure was someone's garage. The owner served only one thing, and we had it seated around a folding table, just us and a space heater. The food was unfailingly good, but what made lunch such a consistent pleasure was the anticipation, knowing that we had the entire afternoon ahead of us and that it might result in anything, styrofoam boots, a suit made of tape, whatever we could imagine was out there waiting to be discovered. All we Sidereses had to do was venture forth and claim it. Leviathan. As I grow older, I find that the people I know become crazy in one of two ways. The first is animal crazy, more specifically dog crazy. They are the ones who, when asked if they have children, are likely to answer a black lab and a Sheltie Beagle mix named Tuckahoe. Then they always add, they were rescues. The second way people go crazy is with their diet. My brother Paul, for instance, has all but given up solid food, and at age 46, eats much the way he did when he was 9 months old. His nickname used to be the Rooster, now we call him the Juicer. Everything goes into his Omega J8006, kale, carrots, celery, some kind of powder scraped off the knuckles of bees, and it all comes out dung-colored and the texture of applesauce. He's also taken to hanging upside down with a neti pot in his nose. It's for my sinuses, he claims. Then there's all his disease prevention, the things that supposedly stave it off, but that the drug companies don't want you knowing about. I've heard this sort of thing from a number of people over the years. Cancer can definitely be cured with a vegan diet, a friend will insist, only they want to keep it a secret. In this case, the they that doesn't want you to know is the meat industry or big meat. If a vegan diet truly did cure cancer, don't you think it would have at least made the front page of the New York Times science section? I ask. Isn't that a paper's job, to tell you the things they don't want you to know? Paul insists that apricot seeds prevent cancer, but that the cancer industry, Big Cancer, wants to suppress this information and has quietly imprisoned those who have tried to enlighten us. He orders in bulk and brought a jarful to our house at the beach one late May afternoon. They're horribly bitter, these things, and leave a definite aftertaste. Jesus, that's rough, my father said, after mistaking one for an almond. How many do you have in a day? Paul said 4. Any more could be dangerous since they have cyanide in them. Then he juiced what I think was a tennis ball mixed with beets and four-leaf clovers. Add some strawberries and I'll have a glass as well, my sister Lisa said. She's not convinced about the cancer prevention, but is intrigued by all the weight our brother has lost. When he got married in 2001, he was close to 200 pounds, which is a lot if you're only 5'2". Now he was down to 135. It's odd seeing him thin again after all these years. I expected him to look the way he did when he was 20, before he ballooned up. And while he's the same physical size he was back then, his face has aged, and now he looks like that kid's father. It's as if a generation of him went missing. Part of Paul's weight loss can be attributed to his new liquid diet, but I think that exercise has more to do with it. He bought a complicated racing bike and rides it while wearing what looks like a Spider-Man costume and the type of cycling shoes that have cleats on them. One day that May, as I walked to the post office, he pedaled past without recognizing me. His face was unguarded, and I felt I was seeing him the way other people do, at least superficially, this boyish little man with an icicle of snot hanging off his nose. "Morning," he sang as he sped by. It's ridiculous how often you have to say hello on Emerald Isle. Passing someone on the street is one thing, but you have to do it in stores as well. Not just to the employees who greet you at the door, but to your fellow shoppers in aisle 3. Most of the houses that face the ocean are rented out during the high season, and from week to week, the people in them come from all over the United States. Houses near the Sound, on the other hand, are more commonly owner-occupied. They have landscaped yards, and many are fronted by novelty mailboxes. Some are shaped like fish, while others are outfitted in cozies that have various messages, "Bless your heart," or "Sandy feet, welcome," printed on them. The neighborhoods near the Sound are so southern that people will sometimes wave to you from inside their houses. Workmen, hammers in hand, shout hello from ladders and half-shingled roofs. I'm willing to bet that the local operating rooms are windowless and have doors that are solid wood, otherwise the surgeons and nurses would feel obliged to acknowledge everyone who passed down the hall, and patients could possibly die as a result. While the Sound side of the island feels like an old-fashioned neighborhood, the ocean side is more like an upscale retirement community. Look out a street-facing window on any given morning, and you'd think they were filming a Centrum commercial, all these hale, silver-haired seniors walking or jogging or cycling past the house. Later in the day, when the heat cranks up, they purr by in golf carts, wearing visors, their noses streaked with sunblock. If you were a teenager, you likely wouldn't give it much thought. But to my sisters and me, people in our mid to late 50s, it's chilling. That'll be us in like 8 years, we think. How can that be when only yesterday, on this very same beach, we were children? Of course, the alternative is worse. When my mother was the age that I am now, she couldn't walk more than 10 steps without stopping to catch her breath. And stairs, forget it. In that regard, our father is her opposite. At 91, the only things wrong with him are his toes. "My doctor wants to cut one off, but I think he's overreacting," he said on the second morning of our vacation. The sun shone brightly through the floor-to-ceiling windows, and he was sitting shirtless at the kitchen table on the side of the house that Hugh and I share, wearing black spandex shorts. The toes he presented from my inspection looked like fingers playing the piano. all of them long and bent and splayed. "How do you fit those things into shoes?" I asked, wincing. "Wouldn't it be easier to go the Howard Hughes route and just wear tissue boxes on your feet?" Just then the plumber arrived to look at our broken dishwasher. Randy is huge in every way, and as we shook hands, I thought of how small mine must have felt within his, like a paw almost. "So it seems to be a problem," he asked. "It's the same story every time. Hugh calls and schedules an appointment regarding something I know nothing about. Then he leaves for God knows where, and I'm left to explain what I don't understand." "I guess it's not washing the dishes right or something," I said. Randy pulled a screwdriver from his tool belt and bent down toward a panel. "Ought to come sooner, but we're still catching up from the winter we had. Pipes froze, all kinds of mess." "Was it that cold?" I asked. "Never seen anything like it," he said. My father raised his coffee cup. "And they talk about global warming. Ha!" After 20 minutes or so, Randy suggested we get a new dishwasher, a KitchenAid, if possible. "They're not that expensive, and they'll probably be cheaper than fixing this here one." I showed him to the door, and as he made his way down the stairs, my father asked when I was going to have my prostate checked. "You need to get that taken care of ASAP. While you're at it, you might want to get a complete physical. I mean, the works." "What does that have to do with the dishwasher?" I wondered. When Hugh returned, I passed on Randy's suggestion regarding the KitchenAid, and he nodded. "While he was here, did you ask him about the leak under the sink?" "I didn't know I was supposed to." "God damn it, I told you last night." My father tapped me on the shoulder. "You need to call a doctor and get a checkup." This was my second trip to our house on Emerald Isle, and the second time my entire family, or what was left of it, was assembling here. Summer was still a month away, and already the temperature was in the 90s. The humidity was high, and once you left the beach, the breeze disappeared, inviting in its dearth great squadrons of biting flies. Still, I would force myself out every afternoon. On one of my walks, I came across my brother and his daughter Madeline standing on a footbridge a few blocks inland from our house and dropping bread into the brackish canal. I thought they were feeding fish, but it turned out they were throwing the food to turtles, dozens of them. Most had shells between 6 and 8 inches long and are what my sister Gretchen, who owns a lot of reptiles, calls sliders. Then there were the snapping turtles. The largest measured around 3.5 feet from nose to tail. Part of his left front foot was missing, and he had a tumor on his head the size of my niece's fist. "And you're giving them bread?" I said to Paul. It made me think of my first visit to Spokane, Washington. I was walking through the park that fronts the river there and happened upon people feeding animals that resembled groundhogs. "What are these?" I asked a man who was kneeling with his arm outstretched. "Marmots," he told me. "And what do they eat?" He reached into a bag he kept at his feet. "Marshmallows." I've subsequently seen people feed all sorts of things to the turtles in the canal on Emerald Isle, dried dog food, Cheerios, Pop-Tarts, potato chips. "None of that is good for them," Gretchen says. Her turtles eat mainly worms and slugs. They like fruit as well, and certain vegetables, but potato chips, no. "What about barbecued potato chips?" I asked. During the week that we spent at the beach, I'd visit the canal every afternoon, sometimes with raw hot dogs, sometimes with fish heads or chicken gizzards. The sliders would poke their heads out of the water, begging, but it was the snappers I was there for. Seeing one was like seeing a dinosaur, for isn't that what they are? Watching as they tore into their food, I'd shiver with fear and revulsion, the way I used to when watching my brother eat. On YouTube, there's a video of one biting off a finger, and of the man whose finger it used to be acting terribly surprised, the way that people who offer sandwiches to bears or jump security fences to pose beside tigers ultimately are. There are other videos of snapping turtles eating rats and pigeons and frogs, all of which are still alive, their pathetic attempts at self-defense futile. It's a kind of pornography, and after sitting for 20 minutes, watching one poor animal after another being eviscerated, I erase my internet user history. Not wanting to be identified as the person who would find this sort of thing entertaining, yet clearly being that person. Did it help, I wondered, that my favorite turtle was the one with the oversized tumor on his head and half his front foot missing? Did that make me a friend of the sick and the suffering, or just the kind of guy who wants both ice cream and whipped cream on his pie? Aren't snapping turtles terrible enough? Did I really need to supersize one with a cancerous growth? My main reason for buying the house on Emerald Isle was that it would allow my family to spend more time together, especially now while my father's still around. Instead, though, I was spending all my time with these turtles. Not that we didn't do anything as a group. One afternoon, we scattered my mother's ashes in the surf behind the house. Afterward, standing on the shore with the empty bag in my hands, I noticed a trawler creeping across the horizon. It was after shrimp or some kind of fish, and hovering over it like flies around a garbage pail were dozens of screaming seabirds. It made me think of my mother and how we'd follow her even to the bathroom. "Can't I have 5 minutes?" she'd plead from behind the locked door as we jiggled the handle, relating something terribly important about tights or a substitute teacher or a dream one of us had had about a talking glove. My mother died in 1991, yet reaching into the bag, touching her remains, essentially throwing her away, was devastating, even after all this time. Later, drained, we piled into the car and drove to the small city of Beaufort. There, we went to a coffee shop and fell in line behind a young man with a gun. It was tucked into a holster he wore belted around his waist, and after he had got his order and taken a seat with two people I took to be his parents, we glared at him with what might as well have been a single eye. Even my father, who laughs appreciatively at such bumper stickers as, "Don't blame me, I voted for the American," draws the line at carrying a pistol into a place where lattes are being served. "What's he trying to prove?" he asked. The guy was my height, or maybe a little shorter, wearing pressed jeans. "He's obviously got a complex of some kind," my sister-in-law Kathy said. "It's called being a Republican," Lisa offered. My father frowned into his decaf. "Oh, come on now." I mentioned a couple of t-shirts I'd seen people wearing on the pier not far from my turtle spot. "Invest in heavy metals," read one, and it pictured three bullets labeled brass, copper, and lead. Another showed a pistol above the message, "When you come for mine, you better bring yours." "Since when is the government coming for anyone's guns in this country?" I asked. "I mean, honestly, can't any of us enter a Walmart right now and walk out with the Sidewinder missile?" It was a nice moment, all of us on the same page. Then my father ruined it by asking when I'd last had a physical. "Just recently," I said. "Recently, like when?" 1987, I told him, adding after he moaned, "You do know this is the fourth time today you've asked me about this, right? I mean, you're not just being 91, are you?" "No," he said, "I know what I'm saying." "Well, can you please stop saying it? I will when you get a physical." "Is this really how you want to be remembered?" I asked. "As a nagger with hammer toes?" "I'm just showing my concern," he said. "Can't you see that I'm doing this for your own good? Jesus, son, I want you to have a long, healthy life. I love you. Is that a crime?" The C-section came completely furnished, and the first thing we did after getting the keys was to load up all the televisions and donate them to a thrift shop. It's nice at night to work puzzles or play board games or just hang out, maybe listening to music. The only one this is difficult for is my father. Back in Raleigh, he has two or three TVs going at the same time, all tuned to the same conservative cable station, filling his falling down house with outrage. The one reprieve is his daily visit to the gym, where he takes part in a spinning class. Amy and I like to joke that his stationary bike has a front wheel as tall as a man and a rear one no bigger than a pie tin, that it's a penny farthing, the kind people rode in the 1880s. On its handlebars, we imagine a trumpet horn with a big rubber bulb on one end. Being at the beach is a drag for our father. To his credit, though, he never complains about it, just as he never mentions the dozens of aches and pains a person his age must surely be burdened by. "I'm fine just hanging out," he says. "Being together, that's all I need." He no longer swims or golfs or fishes off the pier. We banned his right-wing radio show, so all that's left is to shuffle from one side of the house to the other, sometimes barefoot and sometimes wearing leather slippers the color of a new baseball mitt. "Those are beautiful," I said the first time I noticed them. "Where do they come from?" He looked down at his feet and cleared his throat. "Catalog. They arrived back in the early 80s, but I only just recently started wearing them." "If anything should ever happen to you, do you think that maybe I could have them?" I asked. "What would ever happen to me?" In the ocean that afternoon, I watched my brother play with his daughter. The waves were high, and as Madeline hung laughing off Paul's shoulders, I thought of how we used to do the same with our own father. It's the only time any of us ever touched him. Perhaps for that reason, I can still recall the feel of his skin, slick with suntan oil, and much softer than I had imagined it. Our mother couldn't keep our hands off her. If we'd had ink on our fingers, at the end of an average day, she'd have been black, the way we mauled and poked and petted her. With him, though, we never dared get too close. Even in the ocean, there'd come a moment when, without warning, he'd suddenly reach his limit and shake us off, growling, "God almighty, will you just leave me alone?" He was so much heavier back then, always determined to lose 30 pounds. Half a century later, he'd do well to gain 30 pounds. Paul embraced him after our sister Tiffany died and reported that it was like hugging a coat rack. "What I do," he says every night while Hugh puts dinner together, "is take a chicken breast, broil it with a little EVOO, and serve it with some lentils. Fantastic." Though my father talks big, we suspect the bulk of his meals come from whatever they're offering as free samples at his neighborhood Whole Foods, the one we give him gift cards for. How else to explain how he puts it away while we're all together, eating as if in preparation for a fast? "Outstanding," he says between bites, the muscles of his jaws twitching beneath his spotted skin. "My compliments to the chef." One night I looked over and saw that he was wearing a Cherokee headdress someone had brought to the house for Thanksgiving. Paul had put it on him, and rather than shake it off the way he would have a few years earlier, he accepted it, owned it, really. Just before dessert was served, Amy and I noticed that he was crying. He looked like the Indian from that old Keep America Beautiful ad campaign, one single tear running down his cheek. He never blubbered or called attention to himself, so we never asked what the problem was, or if there even was a problem. "Maybe he was happy that we were all together," Lisa said when we told her about it. Gretchen guessed that he was thinking about our mother, or Tiffany, while Paul wondered if it wasn't an allergic reaction to feathers. It's not that our father waited till this late in the game to win our hearts. It's that he's succeeding. "But he didn't used to be this nice and agreeable," I complained to Hugh. "Well, he is now," he said. "Why can't you let people change?" This is akin to another of his often asked questions. "Why do you choose to remember the negative rather than the positive?" "I don't," I insist, thinking, "I will never forget your giving me such a hard time over this." Honestly, though, does choice even come into it? Is it my fault that the good times fade to nothing while the bad ones burn forever bright? Memory aside, the negative just makes for a better story. The plane was delayed. An infection set in. Outlaws arrived and reduced the schoolhouse to ashes. Happiness is harder to put into words. It's also harder to source, much more mysterious than anger or sorrow, which come to me promptly whenever I summon them, and remain long after I've begged them to leave. For whatever reason, I was very happy with my snapping turtles. In the wild, they can live up to 30 years, though I fear that my favorite, the one with the hideous growth on his head, might not make it that long. There's something wrong with his breathing, though he still manages to mount the females every chance he gets. "Oh, look," a passerby said, pointing down into the churning water on the last full day of our vacation. "They're playing." I looked at the man with an incredulity that bordered on anger. "Snapping turtles don't play," I said, "not even when they're babies. They're reptiles, for Christ's sake." "Can you believe it?" I said to my father when I got back to the beach house that evening. He was standing beside the sofa, wearing a shirt I clearly remember throwing into his trash can in the summer of 1990 and enjoying a glass of vodka with a little water in it. All around him, people were helping with dinner. Lisa and Amy were setting the table while Gretchen prepared the salad and Paul loaded his juicer with what looked like dirt. Hugh brought fish up from the grill, and as Kathy and Madeline rounded up chairs, I put on some music. "Attaboy," my father said. "That's just what we needed. Is this Hank Mobley?" "It is," I told him. "I thought so. I used to have this on reel-to-reel tape." While I know I can't control it, what I ultimately hope to recall about my late-in-life father is not his nagging or his toes, but rather his fingers and the way he snaps them when listening to jazz. He's done it forever, signifying, much as a cat does by purring, that you may approach, that all is right with the world. "Man, oh man," he'll say in my memory, lifting his glass and taking us all in. "Isn't this just fantastic?" A Modest Proposal. London is 5 hours ahead of Washington, D.C., except when it comes to gay marriage. In that case, it's 2 years and 5 hours ahead, which was news to me. "Really?" I said on meeting two lesbian wives from Wolverhampton. "You can do that here?" "Well, of course they can," Hugh said when I told him about it. "Where have you been?" Hugh can tell you everything about the current political situation in the UK. He knows who the Chancellor of the Exchequer is and was all caught up in the latest election for the, whatever you call it, that king-type person who's like the president but isn't. "Prime Minister," he said. "Jesus, you've been here how long?" It was the same when we lived in Paris. Hugh regularly read the French papers. He listened to political shows on the radio, while I was like, "Is he the same emperor we had last year?" When it comes to American politics, our roles are reversed. "What do you mean, who's Claire McCaskill?" I'll say, amazed that I, that anyone, for that matter, could have such an ignorant boyfriend. I knew that the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage was expected at 10 a.m. on June 26th, which is 3 p.m. in Sussex. I'm usually out then, on my litter patrol, so I made it a point to bring my iPad with me. When the time came, I was standing by the side of the road collecting trash with my grabber. It's generally the same crap over and over, potato chip bags, candy wrappers, Red Bull cans. But along this particular stretch, 6 months earlier, I'd come across a strap-on penis. It seemed pretty old and was Band-Aid colored, about 3 inches long, and not much bigger around than a Vienna sausage, which was interesting to me. You'd think that if someone wanted a sex toy, she'd go for the gold, size-wise, but this was just the bare minimum, like getting AAA breast implants. Who had this person been hoping to satisfy? Her Cabbage Patch doll? I thought about taking the penis home and mailing it to one of my sisters for Christmas, but knew that the moment I put it in my knapsack, I'd get hit by a car and killed. That's just my luck. Medics would come and scrape me off the pavement. Then, later, at the hospital, they'd rifle through my pack and record its contents: 4 garbage bags, some wet wipes, 2 flashlights, and a strap-on penis. "There must be some mistake," he would tell them. "You said it was how big?" My iPad could get no signal at 3 p.m., so I continued walking and picking up trash, thinking that whichever way the Supreme Court went, I never expected to see this day in my lifetime. When I was young, in the early 70s, being gay felt like the worst thing that could happen to a person, at least in Raleigh, North Carolina. There was a rumor that it could be cured by psychiatrists, so for most of my teens, that's where I placed my hope. I figured that eventually I'd tell my mother and let her take the appropriate steps. What would kill me would be seeing the disappointment on her face. With my father, I was used to it. That was the expression he naturally assumed when looking at me. Her, though. Once, when I was in high school, she caught me doing something or other, imitating my Spanish teacher, perhaps with a pair of tights on my head, and said, like someone at the end of her rope, "What are you, a queer?" I've been called a sissy before, not by her, but by plenty of other people. That was different, though, as the word was less potent, something used by children. When my mother called me a queer, my face turned scarlet, and I exploded. "Me? What are you talking about? Why would you even say a thing like that?" Then I ran down to my room, which was spotless, everything just so. The Gustav Klimt posters on the walls, the cornflower blue vase I'd bought with the money I earned babysitting. The veil had been lifted, and now I saw this for what it was, the lair of a blatant homosexual. That would have been a good time as any to say, "Yes, you're right. Get me some help." But I was still hoping that it might be a phase, that I'd wake up the next day and be normal. In the best of times, it seemed like such a short leap. I did fantasize about having a girlfriend. Never the sex part, but the rest of it I had down. I knew what she'd look like and how she'd hold her long hair back from the flame when bending over a lit candle. I imagined us getting married the summer after I graduated from college, and then I imagined her drowning off the coast of North Carolina during one of my family's vacations. Everyone needed to be there so they could see just how devastated I was. I could actually make myself cry by picturing it, how I'd carry her out of the water, how my feet would sink into the sand owing to the extra weight. I'd try mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and keep trying until someone, my father most often, would pull me back saying, "It's too late, son. Can't you see she's gone?" It seemed I wanted to marry just so I could be a widower. So profound would be my grief that I'd never look at another woman again. It was perfect, really. Oh, there were variations. Sometimes she'd die of leukemia, as in the movie Love Story. Occasionally, a madman's bullet would fell her during a hostage situation, but always I'd be at her side, trying everything in my power to bring her back. The fantasy remained active until I was 20. Funny how unimportant being gay became once I told somebody. All I had to do was open up to my best friend, and when she accepted it, I saw that I could as well. "I just don't see why you have to rub everyone's noses in it," certain people would complain when I told them. Not that I wore it on T-shirts or anything. Rather, I'd just say boyfriend, the way they said wife or girlfriend or better half. I insisted that it was no different, and in time, at least in the circles I ran in, it became no different. While I often dreamed of making a life with another man, I never extended the fantasy to marriage or even to civil partnerships, which became legal in France in 1999, shortly after Hugh and I moved to Paris. We'd been together for 8 years by that point, and though I didn't want to break up or look for anyone else, I didn't need the government to validate my relationship. I felt the same way when a handful of American states legalized same-sex marriage, only more so. I didn't need a government or a church giving me its blessing. the whole thing felt like a step down to me. From the dawn of time, the one irrefutably good thing about gay men and lesbians was that we didn't force people to sit through our weddings. Even the most ardent of homophobes had to hand us that. We were the ones who toiled behind the scenes while straight people got married, the photographers and bakers and florists, working like Negro porters, settling spoiled passengers into the whites-only section of the train. "Oh, Christopher," a bride might sigh as her dressmaker zipped her up, "what would I have ever done without you?" What saved this from being tragic was that they were doing something we wouldn't dream of, guilt-tripping friends and relatives into giving up their weekends so they could sit on hard church pews or folding chairs in August, listening as the couple mewled vows at each other, watching as they were force-fed cake, standing on the sidelines, bored and sweating as the pair danced, misty-eyed, to a foreigner song. The battle for gay marriage was, in essence, the fight to be as square as straight people, to say things like, "My husband tells me that the new spicy Chipotle burger they've got at Bennigan's is awesome." That said, I was all for the struggle, mainly because it so irritated the fundamentalists. I wanted gay people to get the right to marry, and then I wanted none of us to act on it. I wanted it to be ours to spit on. Instead, much to my disappointment, we seemed to be all over it. I finally got a signal at the post office in the neighboring village. I'd gone to mail a set of keys to a friend, and afterward I went out front and pulled out my iPad. The touch of a finger, and there it was, the headline story on the New York Times site: "Supreme Court ruling makes same-sex marriage a right nationwide." I read it, and probably like every American gay person, I was overcome with emotion. Standing on the sidewalk, dressed in rags with a litter picker pinion between my legs, I felt my eyes tear up, and as my vision blurred, I considered all the people who had fought against this and thought, "Take that, assholes." The Supreme Court ruling tells every gay 15-year-old living out in the middle of nowhere that he or she is as good as any other dope who wants to get married. To me, it was a slightly mixed message, like saying we're all equally entitled to wear Dockers to the Olive Garden. Then I spoke to my accountant, who's as straight as they come, and he couldn't have been more excited. "For tax purposes, you and Hugh really need to act on this," he told me. "But I don't want to," I said. "I don't believe in marriage." He launched into a little speech, and here's the thing about legally defined couples. They save boatloads of money, especially when it comes to inheriting property. My accountant told me how much we had to gain, and I was like, "Is there a waiting period? What documents do I need?" That night, I proposed for the first of what eventually numbered 18 times. "Listen," I said to Hugh over dinner, "we really need to do this. Otherwise, when one of us dies, the other will be clobbered with taxes." "I don't care," he told me. "It's just money." This is a sentence that does not register on Greek ears. It's just a mango-sized brain tumor. It's just the person I hired to smother you in your sleep. But since when is money just money? "I'm not marrying you," he repeated. I swore to him that I was not being romantic about it. "There'll be no rings, no ceremony, no celebration of any kind. We won't tell anyone but the accountant. Think of it as a financial contract, nothing more." "No." "God damn it," I said, "you are going to marry me whether you like it or not." "No, I'm not." "Oh, yes, you are." After 2 weeks of this, he slammed his fork on the table, saying, "I'll do anything just to shut you up." This is, I'm pretty sure, the closest I'm likely to get to a yes. I took another ear of corn. "Fine, then. It's settled." It wasn't until the following day that the reality set in. I was out on the side of a busy road with my litter picker. collecting the shreds of a paper coffee cup that had been run over by a lawnmower, when I thought of having to tick the box that says married instead of single. I always thought there should have been another option, as for the past 24 years, I have been happily neither. I would never introduce Hugh as my husband, nor would he refer to me that way, but I can easily imagine other people doing it. They'd be the type who so readily embraced partner when it came down the pike in the mid-90s, well-meaning people, the kind who wear bike helmets. It occurred to me while standing there, cars whizzing by, that the day I marry is the day I'll get hit and killed, probably by some driver who's texting or, likelier still, sexting. He is survived by his husband, Hugh Hamrick, the obituary will read, and before I'm even in my grave, I'll be rolling over in it. That night at dinner, neither of us mentioned the previous evening's conversation. We talked about this and that, our little projects, the lives of our neighbors, and then we retreated to different parts of the house. Engaged, I suppose. Our whole lives ahead of us.